morning. I'm Frank Verastro. I'm the director of the energy program here at CSIS. This topic is extremely timely. We've been working on the NPC, the Petroleum Council study on kind of global energy and this idea of a changing map and changing leverage with new players and changing rules is really a predominant theme that's going through the study. The presenters we have here this morning, Wood Mackenzie is here to talk about global changes in hydrocarbon laws, which is obviously a timely topic. And it's universal around the world. I mean, it can be Venezuela, the United States, the UK, China, Libya, Algeria, Kazakhstan, Russia, take your pick. So I'm hoping that we're going to have a good discussion on this. Wood Mack, I first became acquainted with Wood Mack back in the 70s when I was at the Department of Energy. But since that time, they've really become global in scope. They now cover over 90 countries in terms of research and analysis that they provide to companies and investors. This morning's presentation, Craig McMahon is going to walk us through it because of Craig's background. He'll be the main presenter this morning. He does mainly North Africa, so while the focus will be global, I expect we'll spend, I haven't seen the presentation yet, but I expect we'll spend more time on Libya and Algeria, for example, but maybe in the discussion we can go broader than that. He's also joined this morning by Jim Lever and Bill King from Wood Mackenzie. I'd also like to acknowledge, and Haim's here, that we're co-sponsoring this event with the Middle East program. So, Haim, thank you very much. And Craig, with that, why don't we just let you get started. We're going to go around the room just real quickly, and if you can just identify yourselves so that they know who's in the room. This is entirely on the record, and the presentation will be posted on our website. Okay? So, thank you. And why don't we start? Go ahead. Okay.
Yeah, Craig McMahon from Wood Mack as well. Thank you. Cheers, Frank. I guess the first thing I should do is, well, a couple of things. First of all, can everybody hear me properly? Yeah. Secondly, can everyone understand me properly? Which might be a little bit more pressing. As you've probably guessed already from what limited words I have said, I'm based out of Wood Mack's headquarters in Edinburgh. Secondly, we'd like to thank the CSIS for the very kind invitation of presenting to such a distinguished audience today. And also thank you for making the temperature that, you know, extra bit colder just to make me feel at home. Feel as if we're back in Edinburgh, albeit it's slightly drier. If we could maybe just start with just a very, very quick introduction to Wood Mackenzie. I mean, we're not here to give any sort of sales pitch, but really just to set the scene for who Wood Mack is and how we've come to be. The company itself was established in 1973, so we have now, you know, knocking on 35 years of experience in the oil and gas industry. We consider ourselves as being the leading research and consultancy house focusing on upstream issues, energy markets and downstream as well. We now employ over 250 industry consultants. That's 250 people who are in essence working on the actual analysis which we produce through our research and consultancy offerings. Each team is multidisciplinary. From that perspective, we try to replicate the demographic of an oil company. So, for example, I work within the Africa team, so we have a geologist, we have an economist, and we have an engineer. And from that, we try to replicate that demographic. As I've mentioned, we're headquartered in Scotland, but we now have offices and large regional presences in London, Boston, Singapore, and Houston, with other offices and smaller offices, albeit in Dubai, Singapore, Tokyo, Beijing, KL, and Moscow. Also interesting to note that, you know, we are truly independent, which I think is one of the big advantages of Wood Mackenzie. We consider our voice to be truly independent, and you know, as a as an independent third party commenting on issues. Previously, through our generations and evolution, we have been owned by a number of different banks and investment houses. Most recently, Deutsche Bank were our owners. However, in December 2001, there was an employee buyout, and now we are truly and genuinely independent. This just gives a rough indication of the upstream coverage that our research and consultancy offerings cover. So you can see, in essence, we basically cover the entire oil and gas upstream world. This gives you an indication of some of the products which we offer the industry, starting from an upstream perspective, looking at field-by-field analysis in our upstream service, looking at field-by-field fiscal terms in our global economic model, and then moving down to look at some of the more corporate positions and analysing the issue from a corporate perspective. We also now have a full gas and power suite of products, focusing primarily on the North American gas and power business, also in the European business, and also the emerging energy markets, and critically also the growing importance of global LNG in the world is covered within our LNG offering. Furthermore, we always have had a downstream team, but one of the new elements to Wood Mackenzie's offerings is taking a global view on hydrocarbon supply and demand, and using that global perspective, which is really built up from the field-by-field analysis across the upstream world to assess and forecast future production, supply and demand, and the obvious implication on prices. So that's the introduction to Wood Mackenzie. In terms of the actual agenda for the discussion, which I'm here to present, we'll be looking primarily at North Africa. However, I'm very keen to place North Africa, and in particularly Algeria and Libya. I had actually intended also to do Egypt, but the situation and the slide started to grow, and the third factor was becoming all the larger, such that I've decided to remove Egypt. It's probably less topical for this particular issue than Libya, and certainly less topical than Algeria. So we'll place these two countries from a North African perspective, looking at some comparisons with some international countries. Then in more detail, we'll actually assess Algeria with specific reference to some of the recent hydrocarbon law changes in the country. President Bouteflika brought in a new hydrocarbon law in 2005 and then amended it in 2006. Critically, also introduced a petroleum windfall tax, and that will certainly be something which we'll focus on in some detail this morning. We'll then move on to consider the challenge that is Libya. For many companies, seen as the great white hope for North Africa in terms of future production potential and prospectivity. However, the Libyans, in tackling this challenge from our perspective, have made a few errors, or certainly on face value have made a few errors, and we'll assess some of the challenges which the Libyans are currently facing. And then obviously we'll bring to the end with some sort of summary and conclusion. So first of all, looking at North Africa from an international perspective, these are the areas which I cover as a North Africa's senior analyst within Wood Mackenzie, starting in the east with Egypt, through Libya, Tunisia, Algeria, and Morocco. The first slide, which I'm going to show here to set the perspective, apologies, it's quite a busy slide. Most of them aren't as busy as this. It's looking at country liquid production forecast and also the country gas production forecast. We've taken the North African countries and charted them against some other international producers. Should mention that this forecast has been put together using our macro oil service, so there is a contribution from future exploration success. There's also a contribution from field redevelopment projects, and there's also a production contribution from marginal fields or discoveries which have not yet been developed or where there's not a development plan currently in place. From the liquids chart, we can see, first of all, that Algeria in 2007 was producing approximately about 2 million barrels of liquids per day, probably around about 1.5 million barrels of oil, but Algeria being a very large gas player also produces a lot of associated condensates and LPGs. But critically, this is the Algeria line here. We can see that there will be some increase, but only very moderate increases through to 2020, and all we see production being fairly stable. Libya, however, is a bit more of a is a bit more buoyant in terms of production. At the moment, sitting again round about 2 million barrels per day, but we forecast some significant growth. And much of this growth will really be dependent on how successful the Libyans are at actually developing their upstream sector, and that's some of the challenges they face today. In terms of gas, Algeria is a much more prominent player. Algeria currently, as a pioneer in LNG, currently accounts for about 15% of global LNG volumes. Further to that, they also export gas by pipe into southern Europe because of their very close geographic position to Spanish and Italian markets. So we can see that, they're certainly not headlining these liquid or gas production profiles, but they're certainly prominent and important players. Now move on to look at reserves and commercial value. This first chart here charts remaining liquid and gas reserves, liquids underpinning the gas reserves here. Going off the scale, we have Venezuela and also Qatar. Venezuela primarily due to its heavy oil reserves in the Orinoco Belt, and also Qatar because of its massive, massive gas reserves. However, if we place Algeria and Libya particularly in comparison with US regions like Lower 48, Norway, Kazakhstan, even Angola, which is certainly perceived as being a massive oil province, which has emerged and looks like continuing to grow into the ultra-deep water, we can see that the North African countries hold their own pretty well. Moving on to look at combined investor value, essentially what this chart is showing is the remaining commercial value from investors in these countries. So once again, we see that Algeria and Libya really comes up pretty strong against this international comparison, with anywhere between about $120 and $130 billion worth of commercial value still being held by investors in those two countries. Egypt is much less, but still not insignificant. The next two charts we're going to look at, one of them is assessing exploration success to some extent. It's actually looking at value creation. This is a chart which was published by Wood Mackenzie from our exploration strategy and performance study, which was published about a couple of years ago, I guess now, Jim, yeah. In essence, what our definition of value creation, which is charted here, is looking at the overall value which was generated from exploration activities and subtracting exploration and appraisal costs and also signature bonuses. So that's our definition of value creation. Now, from that, 102 countries were actually analysed, and Egypt, Algeria and Libya focused in the top 13 of those 102 countries. So what that gives an indication is these numbers actually relate to the position they came in on that particular study, is that this region has been very successful in terms of exploration over the last 10 years. It's not been insignificant. So what we've said so far is that we've had good exploration success, we have healthy reserves, we have growing production, we have oil and gas. So it's no surprise to see that this North African region is pretty popular to the bulk of IOCs for investment, and that comes at a cost. The government obviously appreciates that, and this chart here shows the percentage of government take on a percentage pre-take NPV at a discount rate of 10%. And again, we charted some of the same countries against it. We can see that government take is particularly high in the North African countries of Algeria, Libya, and even Egypt is still pretty high. So it's prospective, it's successful, it's high production. It's actually a very low cost operating and capital cost environment as well. So those pluses come at an obvious cost, and that cost is the tough fiscal terms. Now, these tough fiscal terms have already existed. This is nothing new. But what we're about to discuss is the fact that the tough fiscal terms have just got a hell of a lot tougher. And that's what we'll build on to look at now. Sure. as far as I'm aware, it's a straight take comparison. So I'd be assuming, you know, in an environment like the UK, for argument's sake, the sort of corporation tax would be considered as government take from that perspective. I mean, certainly it's no surprise to see the UK and the US as being the most lenient from a taxing perspective, certainly compared to the PSE regimes, which are obviously much, much tougher. To some extent, I think that's probably true, yeah. But certainly the bulk of these are PSE regimes as well, so I think in those examples that it's certainly apples with apples. Should probably mention we're actually rerunning this study just now. This was taken from our global oil and gas risk and reward study from a couple of years back, so you know, it's not the very latest information, but we're rerunning that study just now and doing a multi-client on government take, which is assessing some of the issues we're discussing today. And certainly in that, it's apples with apples. So just to summarise the North African perspective, if you like, from the international viewpoint, North Africa remains primarily a gas player. It's a major international gas exporter through pipe to southern Europe and also through LNG to North America and indeed to Europe as well. But it's also not an insignificant liquid producer as well. Some very significant volumes from Algeria and Libya and some very strong forecast growth, particularly out of Libya. And still, as I say, some massive Berkin Basin liquid developments in Algeria. North Africa is viewed very attractively by IOCs, as we've said. However, the cost of that is the very tough fiscal terms and the fiscal environment. And because the bulk of these countries are now using competitive bidding for licensing rounds and for development opportunities, putting companies against companies is resulting in even tougher fiscal terms, which we'll go on to consider when we look at Libya. So let's drill in a little more detail into Algeria. This is an overview of the Algerian upstream map. What we have in various different basins. Down here we have wet gas being produced from the Elise Basin. Up here we have one of the main oil producing areas, which is the Berkin Basin, dominated by Anadarko and partnered by Eni and Maersk. In this area here we have one of Sonatrach's large oil fields, well, its largest oil field called Hassi Messoud. Moving further north we come to Hassi Armel, which is the real backbone of Algeria. This is a massive wet gas field, originally with reserves in excess of 100 TCF of gas. And this is the field which has really given Algeria its international gas position through the last three decades. Moving down to the southwest, this is a dry gas zone. There's not much production from here at the moment, with the exception of BP and Statoil's Insular gas development, which came on stream a couple of years back now. However, this is viewed as being the future of Algeria's gas business, albeit that, as I say, there's only one development on stream just now, and some of the economics and some of the reservoir challenges in this area are not insignificant. Okay, so if we have an overview of the actual Algerian fiscal regimes, various different contract types actually applied within Algeria. Essentially, PSEs predominate, that's for sure, with one or two, particularly one notable exception, BHP, as Ohanet development is essentially very similar to Iranian, an Iranian buyback contract. But we have various different types of PSC regimes. We have an IRR-based PSC, which was introduced in the late 1990s. We have more traditional production-based PSCs. And then from 2000, we had the introduction of the K-factor PSC. Essentially, the K-factor PSC is a position whereby, for exploration licensing rounds, companies were invited to bid their K-factor. Now, the percentage of production which the investor would see would be dependent on the pre-agreed production splits multiplied by your K-factor. So you were always invited to bid up to 100% or up to 1, and the company who bids the lowest K-factor, i.e. the company who is willing to give the most production back to Algeria, would win that particular license. And as a result of the introduction of the K-factor PSCs and the introduction of competitive bid rounds, we have seen more and more aggressive bidding taking place since 2001. Future direction is going to change or certainly in theory, is going to change following the passing of a new hydrocarbon law in 2005, which we're about to discuss. New contracts awarded in Algeria will be by concession, tax royalty terms. In those concessions, Sonatrach will assume 51% equity stake in all all the developments, which, you know, just further highlights some of the fiscal uncertainty within Algeria at the moment. Looking at some national and energy development overview from Algeria, I mean, recently there's been a bit of a political power struggle, and this is what we're about to move on to, the real reason for some of the recent changes. Socialist factions within the country have prevented the liberalisation of the energy market. And the ministry now, obviously in conjunction with the government and with President Bouteflika, is now keen and has put in legislation to slow down the rate of development. The backdrop to this is goes back really to 2001, when the then and current Minister of Energy and Mines, Dr. Jacob Khalil, announced a draft hydrocarbon law aimed at reforming the upstream sector. Essentially, what this draft hydrocarbon law was really aimed at increasing foreign investment and privatising the upstream sector, critically not privatising Sonatrach. That's something which would be considered as completely unacceptable, but certainly trying to promote further investment in the upstream sector. Now, that reform was shelved in 2003 following trade union opposition, but reintroduced in 2005. Now, the backdrop to that was that President Bouteflika was looking for re-election in 2004. Now, to gain political support for re-election within Algeria, you need to have the support of the military and you need to have the support of the trade union organisation. The military have always had a bit of a non-committal position on President Bouteflika. They certainly have not been opposed to him, but the trade unions have certainly voiced their opposition to some of the reforms which he has been considering. And that voicing of opposition prior to the general election led to the hydrocarbon law being shelved. As a result, or partly as a result of it being shelved, Bouteflika won his re-election in 2004 with a landslide victory. He immediately put forward the hydrocarbon law, and it was passed within a year in 2005. However, 12 months later, in July 2006, the Algerian government announced critical changes to that law, which were designed to slow down the process and to reverse the potential liberalisation and basically return all the upstream power to the state, or more directly to Sonatrach, the state IOC. Sonatrach had stated that its objective from within Algeria was to try and increase oil production, specifically oil, not just liquids, to 2 million barrels per day by 2010. Now, that's something they've now acknowledged that they, well, frankly, will not do, and they have changed their target to between 1.5 and 1.6 million barrels per day, a far more conservative target, which is basically saying really just maintaining production at its current level. And obviously the implication on future development work has also been scaled back. Critically, at this time, the Algerians also introduced a petroleum windfall tax, which was to be applied to all existing contracts. So that is to say that the sanctity of existing contracts was more than questioned, and that this windfall tax would apply to all contracts, but specifically target certain contracts. That is to say that not all contracts will be treated in the same way. And we'll touch on that in a moment. Okay. Is that us? Yeah. So the key features of the hydrocarbon law as was passed. So this was a law before it was amended. The objectives of the law, as I said, were to basically promote foreign investment aimed at opening up the industry to private investment and to allow market forces to dominate. The idea would be that Sonatrach would no longer be the industry regulator within Algeria, and that would be passed to a new body. And that would allow Sonatrach as an operator to go forth and internationalise its portfolio, similar to the Petronas's, Statoil's, Petrobras's. That's certainly the way the Algerian government sees Sonatrach operating going forward. Existing contracts were initially to remain unchanged, back in summer 2005, but new contracts were to be based on tax royalty. two new regulatory bodies were to be established, Altnaft, who would look after the promotion of the E&P sector, data provision, etc., etc. This was basically doing all the regulatory work that Sonatrach used to do, and a separate one called the Regulatory Authority to look after technical and safety and tariff regulations, etc. So the real future of Sonatrach was to be far more commercially and economically focused. That is to say that within future licensing rounds within Algeria, Sonatrach would participate the same way as any other upstream company would. Sonatrach was initially meant to actually be taking part in submitting bids against BP, against Shell, against whoever else. But obviously some of the amendments which we now look at have changed that situation dramatically. One of the biggest changes was that Sonatrach's future position in all contracts will be 51%. So they will always retain control of all contracts. Previously, the hydrocarbon law had suggested that Sonatrach would have the option to farm in for between 20 and 30%. Gas marketing rights would always be joint as opposed to sole. A lot of the big super major companies were very keen to have sole gas marketing rights, whereby they could get, for argument's sake, an LNG development off the ground on their own in Algeria, which frankly was probably always a bit unrealistic. But now that those gas marketing rights will be joint, and one of the other implications there is that infrastructure will always be owned in partnership with Sonatrach as opposed to sole rights, and that's particularly relevant to things like export pipelines. And also the introduction of this petroleum windfall tax. The windfall tax is effective from 1st of August 2006. The rate of this tax will be based between 5 and 50% whenever Brent is above $30. Now, there's no sliding scale on this. You know, if you're at this 50% range, for argument's sake, and Brent is at $29, then you don't pay any tax. If Brent goes to $30, then you lose half of your income. So there's very little logic to why the Algerians have implemented it in this way. And there's one or two other specific features about the tranching of a PSC which has not been applied, which seems very, very strange in the application of the tax. The rate will be dependent on the nature and vintage of your contract, but all contracts will be affected. Now, that is to say that within Algeria, most contracts have some sort of production limiter. Now, in the traditional PSCs, they had something which was called a price cap, which says when Brent goes above a certain level, your exposure to that higher price will be less. So you get, for argument's sake, 20% of production when Brent is below this baseline price. But once it goes above that, the incremental increase in value, some of that stays with the government, which is a logical PSC which we see elsewhere. It's the full thing, absolutely. There's a few things which are very strange. That's one of them. It's the gross value which is taken, not just that $1 above 30. Yeah. The second thing is that it's the production, the windfall tax is based on production levels. So if you're producing less than, for argument's sake, 20,000 barrels per day, 15%. Less than 40,000, 10%, well, it actually moves up, say 20%. Now, that's just basically the way a PSC would work when calculating your production share. However, that's not the way the tax works. If you go above 40, you go above the next cut threshold, say 40,000 barrels per day, you pay that rate on your gross production, which again is, you know, certainly not logical based on what we would have expected at the time of the announcement. So many of these contracts have price caps, and they're affected less severely. Now, there's other contracts, the K-factor contracts, which we touched on earlier, and these are the contracts where the companies have bid what percentage of production they're in essence willing to give back to Algeria. They also had something which was called a B factor. Now that B factor was the classic, you know, cumulative revenue over cumulative cost, and that was subtracted again from the contractor share. So that is to say, in later field development, when you know you've recovered all your costs and when you know your revenues are still coming in at a very steady rate, that you would not be making so much money at that time. So it's another production limiter. And once again, these contracts have not been affected as severely as the other contracts. Now, those other contracts are contracts with no production limiter at all. That is to say, you get, for argument's sake, 20%, completely regardless of oil price or circumstance. So that is to say, if you're producing at a rate of whatever, and the price is $20, you'll still get 20%. If it's $60, you still get 20%. And these are the contracts that the Algerians have been very, very keen to effect. Yes. I mean, certainly in the case of upstream pipelines, etc., then, yeah, your partner will be Sonatrach, without a shadow of a doubt. I mean, these changes were unlikely to make an effect in the short term, but, you know, if you looked over maybe 20 years, you could start to imagine IOCs owning major pipelines. At the moment, Algeria has a massive pipeline network already, so, you know, you would still try to use that pipeline because it was the most obvious thing to do. But longer term, it would have affected. In terms of downstream processing plants, etc., I'm not 100% sure what the situation is there, but I'd be very, very surprised if it didn't affect them as well. I mean, you know, I tend to focus very much on the upstream, but, yeah, I would be astonished if it never. I mean, Sonatrach is a classic integrated company, so, yeah, I'd be astonished if it didn't make an effect there as well. So the ministry published how these different contract types would be affected by the law in 2006, in December 2006. So the effects of the amendments announced, as I said, in July, was that commercial and regulatory roles within Algeria would remain separate. That is to say that Sonatrach would still cease to be industry regulator, albeit it would retain 51% in all future developments. The fiscal and contractual position, well, it's far from streamlined and it's far from more straightforward. In fact, quite the contrary, it's now far more bureaucratic, with a whole new additional layer of bureaucracy in the form of ALTNAT having been established. And certain activities remain closed to foreign involvement, or certainly ownership, like gas marketing. ALTNAT's position has already been questioned. I mean, this company was established to take over all the regulation and to take over Sonatrach's power within Algeria. Well, with Sonatrach retaining overall power, it's very difficult to imagine ALTNAF standing up to Sonatrach and telling them what's going to happen. However, in the last few months, ALTNAF has actually been showing its teeth a little bit, which I was slightly surprised about when I'd questioned the future of ALTNAF as a body at all. But it certainly seems that it is here to stay. But one would assume that going forward, it's going to be very closely aligned with Sonatrach. And it's also going to be extremely difficult for Sonatrach to internationalise its portfolio. We see a number of NOCs across the world who are very keen in this objective. And certainly we see a number of NOCs within Africa who are very, very keen to try and grow international positions. I would have rated Sonatrach as one of the companies with a chance. I mean, it's incredibly difficult. It's incredibly difficult for any IOCs, you know, with the levels of competition we see in the industry today. But Sonatrach had a chance. I think that chance has, in essence, been taken away. Certainly by doing it by traditional methods of going alone. They may piggyback with other companies, which is something we will touch on later, but it's going to be extremely difficult for Sonatrach to do that, frankly, because they don't have the personnel to do it. You know, they're extremely resource-constrained at the moment, Sonatrach. They have been losing staff hand over fist to other companies within the Middle East and North Africa, primarily Saudi Aramco, who can offer, you know, Sonatrach engineers, you know, 10, 20, 30, 40 times their current salaries. And Sonatrach obviously cannot compete with that, or won't compete with that, given the socialist nature of the country. And as a result, they've been losing lots of staff. So it's very, very difficult to see how Sonatrach will be successful in what was an absolutely key component of the hydrocarbon law. If we now assess the actual effect of the windfall tax on developments, I mentioned earlier that the contracts which would be most severely affected would be the contracts without any price cap or production limiter within those contracts. And the main contracts which are affected by that are the Hassi-Berkeen 404 and El Merk Block 208 developments. These are the blocks which are operated by Anadarko, Eni and Maersk. And there we see Hassi-Berkeen. These are two different charts. The first one is a look at different developments. And the blue shows the NPV10 before the windfall tax, and the red shows the NPV10 after the windfall tax has been applied for the remaining PVs. This one shows the same thing just by company. So in essence, what we can see is that Anadarko, who's obviously a very significant Algerian player, has in essence seen its value, well, it's close to 50% of it's been taken away. That's how severely those contracts have been impacted. Likewise, Eni and Maersk, who are obviously partners in those developments, Eni also has a couple of, well, has one other contract which is also severely affected by this. I did mention earlier that all developments were affected. There is actually one exception to that, which shows one of the very big inconsistencies of this retroactive tax which has been applied, and that's BP and Statoil's Insalag gas development. Now, this is a dry gas development, and that has been it's been decided that's actually immune from the windfall tax. Now, this shows the inconsistency of the Algerians with regards to how this was handled. In December 2005, when the different tax rates for the different contracts was published, it was very clear that it was oil and gas and was calculated on a BOE basis. Now, the reason that BP and Statoil has been successful in having it not apply to Insalat is that the argument put across is that it's actually a revenue-sharing contract as opposed to a production-sharing contract. BP has to market 9 BCM of gas from Insalat. It has joint marketing rights with its partner Statoil and also with its partner Sonatrach. And they managed to find a market for 4 BCM of gas into Italy. And the remaining 5 BCM was actually purchased by Sonatrach and then marketed through Sonatrach's various different contracts. So that gas is, in essence, sold to Sonatrach at the wellhead, hence the argument for a revenue-sharing contract as opposed to production. And they say, as a result of that, it's immune. I know another contract, it's operated by a company called First Calgary Petroleums in the Berkeen Basin, where they have a wet gas development. And my understanding is that that gas will be taxed. Now, that's inconsistent on the grounds that that gas will be sold at the wellhead to Sonatrach, which is identical to the situation on BP's contract. So there is a definite inconsistency in the application of the tax, or certainly a perceived inconsistency on the application of the tax. On why? Well, there's two reasons. There's two things I would say. You know, first of all, I would say one of the reasons is that I met with the minister in Algiers last month, and he was very clear that he's seen the windfall tax as being a tax on liquids. This is a tax on oil. It's not a tax on gas. Now, if you read what has been published, then it's absolutely explicit. This is a tax on oil and gas. Now, there's only three contracts where gas plays a significant, you know, involvement. Insalat, which is dry gas and has been told it's immune. And the other two are two K-factor contracts, First Calgary and also Repsol Gas Natural's Gassy Tweel development. The Gassy Tweel is inherently uneconomic already. You know, so it has a massive minus NPV. So you can tax it if you want, but you already don't have anything to tax. So, you know, it doesn't really affect that. So that leaves you with one contract. Now, First Calgary's history within Algeria is somewhat checkered in that this is a very small independent company. This is their only interest in the world. And in essence, they've picked up a Sonatrach field. They've appraised it extremely successfully, and they've made some other discoveries on the same block and now stand to make a lot of money out of Algeria. Now, First Calgary's objective has always been to sell the company. You know, it's not to, you know, increase reserves from Algeria. So that was a massive bone of contention for the Algerians, that this, you know, small tin pot company, from their perspective, has come in and, you know, will make hundreds of millions of dollars on the back of Algeria's oil and gas. So they can introduce the windfall tax to that contract, which will take more value away from First Calgary. Absolutely, let's do it. Why not? You know, so from their perspective, you know, they obviously see the power that they hold against First Calgary. So I don't think Sonatrach is losing any sleep over taking more cash off them, which is obviously causing a lot of, you know, problems in Calgary for those guys. So what happens next? Well, from the position of the companies who are most severely affected, there is a clause within every contract called a stabilisation clause. Now, getting detail on these clauses is very, very difficult. Algerians are notoriously confidential about their contracts, and as a result, getting this sort of detail is incredibly difficult. But my understanding is that what's contained in these stabilisation clauses actually gives companies a very, very strong argument and a very strong case against the implementation of the windfall tax. Now, all the contracts have some sort of stabilisation clause, but all these guys, from BP onwards, who, as you can see, are not overly affected by the actual tax are taking a pragmatic approach and saying, okay, we think we probably have a case against it, but in the grander scheme of things, we're still looking to grow an Algerian position and we don't want to fall out with you. Furthermore, Sonatrach has made it clear that any company that it's in arbitration with will not be allowed to take part in future licensing rounds, etc. So basically, most companies are accepting it. Now, because Anadarko, Eni, and Maersk have been so severely affected, I mean, we're talking billions and billions of dollars here have been taken from them. Clearly, they're taking a less pragmatic approach and are, you know, going to be seeking the implementation of these stabilisation clauses. And as a result, arbitration as well. It's not likely, it's inevitable. The other question about the impact of the windfall tax is, you know, just how much has this dented investor confidence in Algeria? Well, I mean, the answer to that's pretty obvious. I mean, it's been severely, severely dented. And that's something the Algerians themselves acknowledge. And the first real acid test of how much of an effect it's had will come in the next licensing round, initially scheduled for 2007. That will probably take place in 2008 now. And that licensing round will be for frontier acreage. It will not be for prospective proven zones. Further indication that the actual license, the pace of development is slowing down further. And only then we'll see how many companies turn up and put bids in for these unattractive, in inverted commas, frontier acreage. So the effects of the actual amendments, well, sorry, the reasons for the law amendments, well, I guess we've touched on a lot of these things. Certainly, political pressure within Algeria is very important. The perception that the government has been auctioning off the country's crown jewels, which is clearly not the case. I mean, if you go back and look at the, you know, the percentage of government take, you know, the vast majority of the value is staying in Algeria, but at the same time, it's having a pretty strong effect. Also, Bouteflika is looking for re-election for a third time. You remember when he was looking for re-election for the second time, the hydrocarbon law was taken off. Well, we're seeing something similar. And there's actually got to be a couple of votes on that because he has to change the constitution of the country to actually allow him to be re-elected a third time. And those elections, well, there's actually two sets, as I say, will be coming up at the end of this year and the start of next. The other obvious thing is oil price. It's very, very high. And that's meant that the Algerians have felt that, you know, too much of that upside was being felt by the IOCs, particularly the IOCs with no production limiter. And also this desire to slow down the rate of progress. And the reason for that has been that Algeria has received far, far greater revenues from oil and gas than it actually budgeted for. Like some of the oil companies, I guess, at the moment money's not an issue. We've got plenty of it because of the price. This here is a couple of charts. It's looking at revenue that has been generated from the Algerian oil and gas business. Looking at the price at the start of 2000, the year 2000, and how that was projected forward. So in the year 2000, based on January 2000 prices, the Algerians expected this much to be made, just over 20 billion. In effect, it's been significantly higher in 2006. If you look at how much they've actually made between 2000 and 2006 over that 6-7 year period, again, looking at prices at the start of 2000, which was only $19, they've actually made $230 billion from oil and gas development, which is 77% higher than they had forecast at the start of 2000. So at the moment, we have money. We don't need to be pushing forward at the same rate as we were planning to or had expected to. So what will happen next? Well, it's our belief that very little will happen in the next 3 or 4 years in terms of forward progress. Exploration, licensing, and development will all slow down. Companies will be less aggressive in exploration campaigns. They have to drill commitment wells in some blocks, but some of those blocks are inherently now uneconomic because of the application of the windfall tax. So it's very difficult to see companies taking an aggressive approach to exploration campaigns. The movement to license frontier zones will probably prove unattractive, certainly unattractive to the industry's leading players, but we still expect companies to turn up. You know, there's companies at the moment are opportunity constrained, so we will still see a number of companies attending that next licensing round, albeit that they're going to make it more difficult for small companies to play. We'll see less of, well, we won't see the likes of First Calgary participating in future licensing rounds. And the windfall tax will obviously inhibit development because of its implication on commerciality. Algeria will obviously struggle to attract investment. Not only is commerciality an issue now because of the high tax rates, but also materiality is becoming a big issue for companies. Sonatrach will have 51% control of the pie, so immediately now the super majors are down to 49. So it's going to be very difficult to make the materiality of this work. Sonatrach's focus will remain on integrating and internationalizing its portfolio, so it's going to still try to do this. The big thing that it wants to do is this gas utility position. We've commented on how they have massive gas reserves. At the moment, they have, 15% of the world's LNG market. However, of the exports, 45% of gas exports from Algeria is through LNG and 55% is through pipe. However, the gas export revenues, LNG contributes only 15%. So there's a real disconnect there. But that disconnect shows the value of gas exports to southern Europe through pipe. It beats LNG every time in terms of netback. Now, the problem that Sonatrach has is it's selling that gas into Italy and into Spain. It's selling it to Enel. It's selling it to Eni. It's selling it to Union Fenosa. It's selling it to Gas Natural. And then those companies are making the profit onwards. Now, Sonatrach's not happy with that anymore. Sonatrach wants to establish itself is a European gas utility company and actually make that margin itself. However, it's coming up against some significant opposition in these countries. The only country where it can actually do it is the UK, because the UK has a fully deregulated gas business. Places like France and Spain are fiercely, fiercely opposed to companies like Sonatrach coming in and are very defensive of their own established national utility companies. Now, some of that is really opposed by EU legislation, and it's a major frustration for Sonatrach going forward. Though one other thing I would expect to see a lot more of is asset swaps. This is something which is very interesting to Sonatrach. Sonatrach doesn't have the people to properly grow its position, but it has a number of MOUs with companies like Statoil and Shell. Now, we've seen those MOUs come into effect already. They have gone into partnership with Statoil in Egypt. We expect them to farm into a Statoil block in Trinidad shortly, and they're also looking at some stuff with Statoil in Norway. So clearly Statoil is very, very keen about growing its Algerian position, and the one way you can do that just now is by basically getting into cahoots with Sonatrach, and the way to do that is through asset swaps. The big problem with asset swaps from Algeria's position goes back to this inherent feeling of selling the crown jewels. It goes against the grain. You're actually assessing how much the Algerian position is worth against whatever they're actually gaining is very, very difficult. So there's a deep-rooted fear that they're going to lose out on asset swaps, which are always pretty difficult to actually balance at the best of times. Longer term, as I said, we don't believe that the Algerian government can actually sustain this nationalistic policy. A decrease in oil price would hurt them very, very hard. Production levels are unlikely to grow significantly, if indeed they'll grow at all. And gas prices would also be severely affected by this oil price drop, if it happens, particularly in Italy and Spain, where the relationship between oil price and gas price is very strongly derived. Also, we would question whether Sonatrach is actually capable of managing its upstream sector alone. There is severe shortages in experienced personnel, and this is going to inhibit the development process. There's also a lack in appreciation of technology to tackle Algeria's more challenging reservoirs, specifically looking at the redevelopment of Hassiar Mel and Hassi Messoud. That's the two massive gas and oil fields in Algeria. These fields will need redeveloped in the next 10 years, and whether Sonatrach has the ability to do that is open to debate. Frankly, we also feel that they just don't have enough resources. They're obviously rich in oil and gas, but if they want to maintain their gas position going forward, they're going to have to bring on new gas. And that gas has to be in the southwest of the country, which is controlled by IOCs. Now, that gas at the moment is sub-commercial because of the windfall tax. So the situation is simple. If you want to stay a global player, then you're going to have to develop that gas, which means the windfall tax has to go. So from our perspective, it's inevitable that it will be reviewed, but it won't be reviewed in the short term. And that may come too late for some companies. I am obviously concerned with time. We're over 11 o'clock. And shall we have a quick look at Libya? Sorry.
Just had a question.
Yeah. Okay. Well, the first one, I mean, they have a very strong political relationship with the countries round about them. So, for example, Mali and Chad are places where they've been looking to grow their own position. They have a bloc in Mali, for argument's sake. It's the same basin as in Sonatrach, as in Algeria. Nothing's, you know, particularly to get excited about. Also, you know, the Chad and Mali governments are, you know, you're dealing with extremely, extremely poor countries here. Mali produces nothing. Chad produces through the Chad-Cameroon pipeline, which is, you know, a World Bank and ExxonMobil project. But, you know, the country's still inherently extremely poor, and the upstream, you know, development hasn't taken off even in Chad, and certainly not in Mali. So the influence of Sonatrach is very strong in those countries, because, you know, it's seen as the big brother who actually has been successful and can help. So, yeah, but I would say their influence is very, very strong. In terms of how we're doing our government take calculations, I mean, we do have access to some contracts. They're incredibly difficult to get the information. And obviously, you know, those contracts and the information which we hold has been derived over a number of years. So, you know, we go, we meet with Sonatrach, we also meet with them. With the ministry, and we meet with all the major IOCs as well and discuss what we are, in essence, publishing. Now, to some extent, we are marketing Algeria to the industry and marketing Algeria to new entrants. Now, it may not be particularly attractive today, but it's been attractive in the past and I believe will be attractive again in the future. So it's very much in the interest of the Algerian government that what we publish is actually a pretty true reflection. So, you know, we do get steers here and we get steers there about where we should be moving things. To actually make it, you know, as genuine and as close to reality as possible. And certainly the feedback we get from Algerian IOCs is favourable. It's far easier to get information on the IOC's development than it is on Sonatrach's own. It's incredibly difficult. Yes, very much so. I mean, another example was, going back to First Calgary, they were far more vocal in public about their contract and about what they were doing and what their development plans were. That did not go down well with Sonatrach, and First Calgary had to learn the lesson, and they did learn the lesson, and they're certainly not doing that anymore. To be perfectly honest, I'm not the best person to comment on, you know, the government policy in the States and the Gulf of Mexico and how that success has been derived. And what we can see is, I mean, if you look at reserves on the Gulf of Mexico, you can see that, let's just have a look. Yeah, if you look at the reserves, I mean, Gulf of Mexico is far from winning this international battle. You know, it's a way over here. But yet, if you actually look at the value that's been generated from that, it's from exploration success, it's number one. You know, so clearly, you know, the fiscal regime there is supporting exploration and actually promoting it. Now, the situation when those contracts were signed in Algeria, you know, when Algeria had done pretty well here, it wouldn't do so well if you were to take out, to be perfectly frank, your own discoveries in the Berkine Basin. Now, the real reason, well, from our perspective, that Anadarko, Maersk and Eni received that preferable contract, or now perceived to be preferable contract, was the grounds that Sonatrach didn't believe for a minute you guys would be anywhere near as successful as you were. They never believed the acreage was as prospective as it turned out to be. Now, in effect, what's happening there is that companies, IOCs, are coming in and drilling successfully somewhere that Sonatrach didn't see much value in, and they're now just basically going back and taking the value from them. So I'm afraid I'm probably not the best person to actually comment on the policy from that perspective. And perhaps just, you know, rather than going through all the Libyan situation, let's just look at a couple of slides. I mean, what Libya has done is introduced new EPSA 4 fiscal terms in 2004 following the lifting of US and UN sanctions. Now, what that basically meant was that companies could bid on how much production they were willing to give away, not dissimilar to the situation in Algeria. Government equity and involvement in Libya has always been very high. For these contracts, it was set at a minimum of 65%. However, companies were invited to give away more than that, and you would bid what's called a production allocation. Now, some companies have bid production allocations as low as 6.8%. Now, what that in essence actually means is that if you ever get any production off the ground, then 92.3% will go to the government off the top, almost like a royalty. Now, from that 6.8% that you have left, you will firstly recover your costs, and then maybe 20 years later, once cost recovery has been satisfied, you will then have the you will then share that 6.8% between you and NOC. So these fiscal terms are incredibly, incredibly tough. But what's different about it is, I mean, it's still resource nationalism, but it's actually the IOCs who are bidding it. You know, it's Turkey's voting for Thanksgiving to some extent, is in essence what we're dealing with. Now, we've had three licensing rounds since the introduction of these terms. Now, this is the average production allocation bid. So the average bid the average bid is this line here. So in the first round, it was about 20%. That is to say that 80% goes to the government. Then it moved down to 15%. And then in the third round, it moved up very, very slightly. Now, what we should say is that the first round was a prospective, good prospective blocks. Second round was a mixed bag. And the third round was poor blocks. Now, the effect of that has been that the number of bids received has dropped dramatically. And also the number of companies participating has also consistently dropped dramatically. However, the fiscal terms haven't, you know, which is, just basically shows you that it only takes one company to come in and bid something silly, and that's it, ruined for all. The first round was dominated by Occidental, the second round was dominated by Asian companies, and the third round was dominated by, Asian companies and ENI, and the third round was dominated by Russians, by Tatneft and Gazprom. Just a quick focus on one block. This is analysis which was carried out a number of years ago. Well, it was 2 years ago at the time that the second licensing round had taken place. It looked at block 146, which is in the emerging Mazurk Basin, very prospective. There's a field nearby which is ENI operated called Elephant. Elephant holds just under 700 million barrels of reserves. We've modelled a scenario that sees only 50% spent on ENA, less than 2 billion on capex, which is low. It was fair at the time. If you were to try and do that just now, that number would unquestionably be higher. And an OPEX, which is reasonable, with a first production of 2010. The development economics for Norsk Hydro, who won this block, based on $40 oil, which was realistic at the time, would still see over 12 and a half years before they would get their costs back. So they're not making any money until then. And the break-even cost is over $50. So what we would say here is that this is, in essence, uneconomic. And that's based on making a 700 million barrel discovery. So, you know, we're talking a very, very serious discovery whereby you will still, in essence, make no money. You're on an IRR comfortably less than 10%. So we're seeing companies bid terms which make no possible economic sense or rationale. So the conclusions I would draw from that is that, you know, the bidding strategy of IOCs has to be questioned. You know, they're not bidding on an economic rationale. Do these companies believe that NOC will be willing to renegotiate later on? NOC, from a history perspective, have actually been pretty true to the sanctity of the contracts they've signed, albeit when the contracts are extremely tough already, then it's not that difficult to stick to them. But, you know, I think it's hugely unlikely that NOC will renegotiate. What is NOC's strategy, which I think is far more interesting? Everybody has always said that they want to produce more and produce more quickly. They set a target of 3 million barrels to be produced by 2012. They'll never, ever manage this. I'm now starting to question whether they'll actually do that, whether that really is the actual stated objectives. I think it's far more likely now that you'll see reserves grow much quicker than production, which is in Libya's interest because, as an OPEC member, it's already having its quota cut, and the best way to increase your quota is to increase your reserves. And the second thing is that Libya currently is seeing free exploration. You know, these companies, NOC pays nothing for exploration. The companies come in, drill 4 or 5 wells, make some discoveries, turns out to be uneconomic, you refuse to renegotiate. Within 5 years from initial award that has to be handed back to NOC, NOC has now increased reserves, discovered new fields, and paid nothing. But overall, I mean, it's a valid and fair strategy, but it certainly will not result in production growing quickly. And once again, this is a similar chart for Libya, just showing how much oil and gas revenues have grown. What will happen next for Libya? Well, we see little change in the next 2 years. It's very difficult to see how NOC can, because politically within Libya, these license rounds have been considered as a huge success. The fact that some companies are willing to give away 93-94% of production has actually made things extremely difficult for NOC, because the question is now being asked, why have you been signing these contracts beforehand where you're giving away 15% or 20%? And the answer is because, well, they're economic contracts, something will actually result, development will proceed, but then that message is not heard within the political powers in Tripoli. Longer term, we don't see competitive rounds being maintained. The big opportunities within Libya are for field redevelopment. Now, NOC doesn't have the EOR skills or technological capability to do this. They're at least 25 years behind because of sanctions in terms of technological appreciation. So they actually need to make sure they get some IOC involvement here. However, the Libyans, like the Egyptians and, in fairness, like the Algerians as well, are very clear about who they want to work with. They want to work with the US and the Western IOCs. These are, without question, their operators and partners of choice. However, by having competitive bid rounds, you're leaving yourself very open to companies who are government-backed from places like Japan and Russia, who can actually bid tougher terms. So the result of that is that you don't get the partner that you want. Now, I believe that the Libyans are more than happy or content or will allow some, you know, Asian-backed, government-backed Asian companies to explore. I don't believe for a minute they will allow them to redevelop these big fields, because this is absolutely critical to the future of the country. The companies who will be doing that will be the Occidentals, the Chevrons, the Exxons, the BPs, the Shells, the people they know, trust and like to work with. And the only way you can do that is to get a small group of them together and bid off amongst the three of them, or the four of them, or the five of them. So that's how we see it happening. So overall conclusions. North African governments unquestionably recognise oil and gas as a strategic commodity, and there has been a big push towards resource nationalisation. The sanctity of contracts is under threat, has already been seen, particularly in Algeria. But the Libyans tend to be a bit better about actually honouring their contracts. The effect, well, it really does limit new investment opportunities for IOCs, big challenge for them. Also the commerciality because of the terms, and the materiality because of the high government equity is challenging the attractiveness of these developments for IOCs. And the knock-on effect is actually harder for IOCs to meet their own government's increasing energy requirements, one of the obvious knock-on effects. What's different about North Africa? I believe it's a short to medium-term phenomenon. I don't think this is the same as Venezuela, for argument's sake. The difference is being that the North African governments and NOC recognise their need long-term for IOCs. They actually want to be strong political allies with the West and with the US. Their governments are pro-US, as opposed to the position in Venezuela, for argument's sake. However, despite the fact they want to work with Western IOCs, they are notoriously tough negotiators, and they're also very well aware of the interest and competition from the Chinese, Asian, and Russian companies. Now, these companies, security of supply is obviously a massive, massive issue for them. And, you know, the Libyans and the Algerians will still ultimately, I believe, do the deal that's best for them. They want to work with the American companies, but at the same time, they are acutely aware of the competition. How quickly things will change? Well, I think that's a function of the oil price. Also, how quickly indigenous production will fall, and also how quickly the competition levels within these countries will fall. It should fall in the next couple of years, and we've seen some evidence of that happening already. Furthermore, the recognition from NOCs that they frankly can't do this themselves. They don't have the people, the personnel, the skills, and the technology to address these challenges going forward. So it's decision time for investors. From our perspective, the prize is definitely worth the wait, but there is a wait involved in it, particularly in Libya, for the massive oil and gas developments. But it's critical to make sure that you're a winner, because the competition will not go away, And when it finally does open up, or when the invitation to attend does come, the competition will be fierce, and there will be far more losers than there will be winners. Thanks. Well, taking the second point first, I mean, absolutely, in my opinion, that's exactly the situation we're in. You know, there was a lot of talk about OPEC defending $50 oil. I think when oil did start to drop, they actually defended it a bit earlier than that, to be perfectly honest. So undoubtedly, that's the new oil price paradigm that we have just now. And these companies are reaping the benefits of it. These countries are reaping the benefits of it. And, you know, already we can see in places like Libya, you know, they're cutting back in production already, you know, and the Libyans are not in the most strong position of OPEC members, in fact, far from it, but yet they are towing the line to an extent. I mean, they still overproduce, but they'll always overproduce, but they are cutting back on IOC-operated production within the country. And in terms of bringing things on, at the moment the situation is no rush, absolutely no rush. Absolutely.
And a note of agreement and pessimism to your Libya analysis.
This is very uplifting, by the way.
I run a U.S. Libya Business Association, and we traveled there in December and met with the NOC. And I mean, I think what we took away from there is that the NOC staff fully understands they need to do bilateral deals for enhanced oil recovery, and they're absolutely terrified to do it. And they're terrified to do it because they have a new National Petroleum Council with all of Ghanem's enemies looking over their shoulder. They're afraid to do it because they don't have strategic planning capacity, so they fear any deal they will cut will be criticized for being the wrong company or the wrong price. And Ghanem himself is extremely unpopular within there, so the long knives would be out for him at the first chance. So I think until he goes, which is always rumored but not yet occurring, it's unlikely that they will do those deals purely for internal political reasons, even though they recognize the economic realities. So you're probably looking at a couple of years before they can bring themselves to do it. The expansion on enhanced oil recovery or the fast progress will probably be within existing deals that they have now that were done pre-EPSA and probably not through the EPSA process.
I mean, I completely agree with you. I mean, it was only last week I was hearing some very strong rumors that, you know, Abdullah El Badri was still pulling a lot of the strings behind the scenes. Now, he's now Secretary General for OPEC, so as far as I'm concerned, he should be pretty busy already. But he's still got a voice in Libya, which, you know, has an effect. My concern would be with the removal of Ghanem, which will happen ultimately, eventually. You know, I don't see it in the short term, to be perfectly honest, but, you know, it will happen one day. You know, the one thing which is sure about Gaddafi's regime is that nothing's certain. And unpredictability reigns, and that's the way he likes to keep it. But, you know, I would still say Ghanem's very much a reformist and is someone who's very keen to cut these deals. If he goes, I would expect him to be replaced with a traditionalist and a more hardliner, which is actually going to see even more difficult, potentially, to do the deal. But I completely agree with you about the difficulty in actually doing it, because who wants to be the person that does the deal? I mean, people, you know, there was 18 blocks signed in 2003 under EPSA 3 terms. Now, the government take level on that's about 80%, probably, around about 80%, we'd expect. You know, less than 12 months later, companies are bidding 10%, you know, and are, you know, in essence, giving a minimum government take of 90. That immediately makes those deals look bad. Now, those deals aren't bad, because the government take there at 80% is a real deal. Something will happen there, development will be allowed to proceed, whereas the deal you've signed is going nowhere. You know, nothing will happen with those fields for at least, you know, 7 years. You know, you'll take them back after 5, then you'll offer them again. Somebody will come in and blow their head away with another crazy bid. You know, so you know, where does it actually get you to? And for me, it has to go back to what's the overall objective. If your overall objective was to increase production, then they've done it very poorly. The one other point I would make about, you know, I completely agree again that the greatest potential for redevelopment in the EOR clearly comes from the existing contracts. Now, the one contract that allows that is clearly the Oasis, the Oasis Waha contract, ConocoPhillips, Marathon and Hess. And critically, because they have the renegotiation and the extension of the licence, the time is there. At the moment, we're not seeing much movement from NOC. You know, they're not doing a lot. There's been no big shift in development plans in the last couple of years. Okay, we've seen over a dozen E&A wells drilled last year, and, you know, they're tinkering at it. But that investment, you know, 50% of that investment has to come from the Libyans. And at the moment, they're holding on to that cash. And we're also seeing further evidence of some of the smaller players that happen to know that Petro-Canada were looking to drill a couple of very simple, straightforward development wells that would have increased production from this given field by, say, 2,000-3,000 barrels per day. Not massive, but, hey, it all helps. It's a very old, mature, and, you know, fairly small field. The Libyans decided they wouldn't devote their money to that. They decided to drill an exploration well that had a prospect size of 100 million barrels, which came in. No plans to develop the field, you know, but that's what they put their money on. So they had a choice here of reserves or production, and they chose reserves. I mean, I guess that's a phenomenon which is happening across the world. Certainly in the position of North Africa, I'm not 100% convinced that penny's dropped yet, certainly not in Libya. The Libyans are still, you know, they're really keen on working with the American companies. It's who they want to work with. You know, and certainly if you speak privately to the key people within the NOC, and you know, the key people amount to, you know, half a dozen people at the most, then, you know, they're absolutely clear about who they want to work with. And it's specifically with oil and gas companies rather than with Halliburton or Schlumberger. But yeah, I mean, I think that's a massive issue going forward, and one that we can obviously see significant effects of, you know, an increase in service contracts, for argument's sake. I mean, the Libyans have tinkered with potentially bringing that back for their marginal fields. I mean, they have something like 250 fields which are lying dormant, which have been discovered over the last 30 years, and previously, for technology or probably more oil price, were never developed. You know, which are now ideal candidates for development and also ideal candidates for service contracts if they wanted to go down that road. My gut feeling is they still won't. I still think they'll offer more traditional type contracts for the selected partners that they want to work with. But from a global perspective, I mean, I guess that's still a massive issue. If you have any more you wanted to add to that, Jim? I mean, it could well be. I mean, in terms of other companies or other countries looking at North Africa, I think there's probably already been quite a lot of North Africa looking at other countries. You know, the political relationship between Chavez and Venezuela and Bouteflika and Algeria is well known. Now, despite the fact Bouteflika is unquestionably pro-Western, if you like, well, certainly from an Algerian perspective, he is anyway. He's still, you know, inherently socialist. You know, they've already learnt the lessons from looking at places like Venezuela. Now, whether other countries will look at North Africa, you know, there's an obvious argument to say they will. I still think that North Africa still kind of gets in under the radar a little bit, and I still think these other nations would be looking more directly at Venezuela. But certainly, you know, it has to be a push to move into these other energy sources on the grounds that, you know, the power that the IOC has is diminishing all the time. You know, IOCs obviously have plenty of money just now because of the oil price, but, you know, you actually can't buy it just now. You know, it's just not available to buy the opportunities. So as a result, anything you can do to kind of make your hand stronger, i.e. your dependence on those opportunities, must be positive. So if you can't get your energy sources from elsewhere, then I guess it lowers your requirement, you know, to deal with these countries, which, you know, must put you in a better bargaining position. I think there's a lot of evidence to say that's the case in Libya, and I think there's a lot of evidence to say that's what's happening just now overall. I'm not I think that's exactly what it is just now, yeah. I think it's because they've got the money. And I mean, I think that's why it goes back to, you know, what the effects of a drop in oil price would have on all these policies would be fascinating to see. At the moment, we just do not need more production, is where they're coming from. You know, they still want to keep the industry ticking over. And, you know, obviously if they can increase their reserves, then not only, you know, does that prolong this for future generations, which I actually don't believe is just a soundbite. I believe that is actually a genuine belief in places like Algeria, who, as I say, I've said a number of times, are inherently socialist, that I think that is something they should be doing. I don't think they're going about it the right way, though. At the moment, what they're doing is they're taking more and more production from their massive strategic resources. Hassi Armel and Hassi Messaoud, they're producing these things to death at the moment. Hassi Armel, they've had to bring forward some compression projects which were not planned for about 3 or 4 years down the line. The field is starting to struggle. Now, from my perspective, you should be inviting as much IOC oil and gas onto the market as much as possible, because the IOC pays for it. You're still taking, 80-85% of the revenues anyway, and that actually alleviates the burden on your massive big fields, which are 100% Sonatrach, which can be retained for future generations. It's these fields which have actually given Algeria the position it has in the global oil and gas industry, and those are the fields that should be getting looked after. What's actually happening is those fields have been depleted. Then they will get to a stage where they'll be, well, we don't have enough gas for all these LNG and pipes, and new pipes that they're talking about as well. And at that stage, there'll be a massive shift in direction, and IOCs will be, you know, we'll be the best friends again and trying to get these things developed as quickly as possible to meet the long-term contracts which have been signed. So what I would suggest and what we believe is they should be doing that just now, getting that IOC gas and oil on from wherever, you know, at the very tough terms. I mean, you know, it's no stroll in the park. It never has been. That's why I think some of the additional tax in Algeria is so harsh, because it was already tough. You know, so that's the perspective that we come from just now. But at the moment, it certainly looks like reserves beat production. Yeah. I mean, you know, we're not political analysts, but obviously working in these regions, you have to have an appreciation of it. And certainly what I've heard with speaking to some of the IOCs and some of the Algerians is that what we've seen in the last 6 months is a little bit different from what we've seen in the past. And, you know, this is a bit of a new phenomenon, that it may well be easier for Al-Qaeda or Al-Qaeda, you know, sponsored groups to infiltrate places like Morocco, Algeria. I wouldn't expect to see it so much in places like Libya, but certainly Algeria and Morocco being classic examples, than it is to infiltrate other countries because of the obviously increased measures in terms of security. But we definitely have seen an upturn in violence, which is pretty obvious, just looking at the news wires recently. And I think the main function of that is actually, the impending elections. It's not unusual. We see the same thing in Nigeria, for argument's sake, every single time it comes round. And it's just putting more and more pressure on Bouteflika. At the moment, he is a man who is under immense pressure. And further to that, his health has been failing pretty dramatically, to the extent that most people would, most commentators suggest he probably won't be here for very long now. But despite that, he's pushing for this third term, which, as I said, involves a change to the constitution. But overall, his position is just very, very weak at the moment. And when you have a weak government and a weak president, then this really, gives momentum and power to those opposition groups, be they genuine opposition or be they terrorist groups, to increase their presence and political lobby. And I guess that's exactly what we're seeing just now. But Bouteflika has always had quite a close relationship with the West. I mean, he's been elected, he was brought to power on a ticket of reconciliation for Algeria. And to be fair, he's been very, very successful at that. But it looks like he now has a new challenge on the horizon. I completely agree. I mean, it's a massive unknown in some of the bids that we've seen from the Asian companies, particularly in the second round in Libya. And it would be nice to give you an answer that this is what they're doing, but it's very, very hard to say. I mean, either they've just not done their maths correct, which is possible, and they've actually made some pretty bullish bids based on an oil price which most companies wouldn't use. Also, they tend to have a very aggressive approach to discount rates. I understand some of them have been using discount rates of between 4 and 6%, which certainly helps in your economic evaluation when everyone else is using probably 10. The other thing is, would they be willing to produce it at a loss? There's a perception that security of supply is absolutely paramount to these companies, and I guess we'd need to wait and see. I personally don't believe they would. My experience, particularly of Chinese companies, where the perception is held is that...
We're going to disagree on that point, but go ahead.
My perception of Chinese companies is that they tend to bid pretty honest terms, tough but honest. They can make money on that. And the economics is unquestionably a massive benchmark, as it should be, even for them. Now, the fact that some of the Japanese companies who were state-sponsored in that particular round could push the economics further, do they believe that NOC will renegotiate? Well, some people believe NOC will renegotiate come the time. And I think there's an argument to say they'll renegotiate some contracts. However, I do not believe they'll renegotiate contracts with Japanese companies because they fundamentally do not want to work with them. Now, whether that's fair or not, it's neither here nor there. At the end of the day, the game belongs to Libya, and they will pick the players that they want to deal with, ultimately, and it will not be those companies. Well, the one other thing you can say is that... Well, the competition levels are so fierce. The 60 different companies took part in that round, 60 different companies. So someone was always going to do something. Now, it was heralded as being a great opportunity, massive oil and gas, underexplored, redevelopment, gas. It has everything. So it was obviously a place to be seen to be doing business. The other thing is that it actually doesn't cost them that much. Now, this is where the Libyans have made a massive error. Essentially you can come in, your commitment wells will be maybe 2 wells, signature bonus maybe 10 million. This whole exploration campaign is going to cost you 30 or 40 million. Now, I'm not suggesting that's not a lot of money, but in the greater scheme of things, it's going to be okay. Now, the way the Angolans done their licensing round was they fixed very fair fiscal terms, tough but fair, and just had the signature bonus as the bidding parameter. People bid over $1 billion. Now, that's money you have in your pocket from the Angolan perspective. The fiscal terms are still fair. If you make a 100 million barrel discovery, which has an NPV of 200 million, which doesn't get you your signature bonus back, you're still going to develop it. You know, so overall, you're still, you know, still at a loss. But the Angolans are winning hand over fist on both counts. Now, the Libyans have just not gone down that road. And from our perspective, that's an error.
I'm thinking more of the Asian companies. I'm thinking of the Indians, and I'm thinking of the Chinese. And I think it's purely about driving their economies going forward. And that's flat out. I mean, that's purely what their whole goals are. Now I'm not in depth on North Africa either, but purely in terms of the Chinese and the Indians, it's about the economy.
At any cost. At any cost.
Security of supply, no matter where it is.
Yeah, I mean, first of all, just to caveat the pro-US, I mean, that's a relative term for, you know, for a essentially, you know, pretty seriously socialist country. But he's been certainly very, very close to the US in terms of trying to get some support for dealing with the internal issues he had with insurgency within Algeria. And he certainly, you know, is heralded is a strong word to use, but he's supported by the American government for those initiatives. In terms of how they feel about gas forums, etc., the Algerians have tried to establish these for a number of years, you know, and you know, with countries like Libya and Egypt and even Yemen and small countries. And frankly, the internal squabbling has made, you know, those attempts into a bit of a laughing stock. And Algeria was unquestionably the driving force behind those initiatives. Now, traditionally, they've always considered the Russians and Gazprom as being a massive competitor. Now, that approach has slightly shifted recently in that they signed an MOU with Gazprom. And to be perfectly honest, I think that makes pretty good sense from Algeria's perspective. They are never, ever going to beat the Russians in terms of volumes. But the Russian gas is entering Europe from the east, obviously. Now, from southern Europe, despite the fact it has lesser volumes, Algerian gas is far more economic and far more attractive than Russian reserves. So Sonatrach still has some cards to play here. Now, the big thing that Gazprom doesn't have and what it wants from an international perspective is LNG volumes. Now, here is somewhere where we can potentially talk to you guys, you know, and you can see how, you know, there can be, you know, there actually can be some working together between the two companies. But I would still suggest that Sonatrach is still very, very wary of the Russian presence.